Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight on this wet Sydney afternoon. Don Watson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's well known to you all, so I will introduce him briefly. His book, Recollections of a Bleeding Heart, A Portrait of Paul Keating, PM, won the Age Book of the Year and non-fiction prizes and other prizes as well. His quarterly essay, Rabbit Syndrome, Australia and America, won the Alfred Deakin Essay Prize. And, of course, Death Sentence, Don Watson's best-selling book about the decay of public language, won the Australian Booksellers Association Award in 2003. And he's written many other books and articles, but today he's here following the publication of Don Watson, American Journeys, to talk for us. And because Don spent a bit of time in the United States before the recent presidential election, we've asked him to talk for us tonight on American Journeys after the presidential election. Don Watson, many thanks.
Thank you, Jared. I'll start with... There's a poem by Walt Whitman, who I know can be a bit fruity, but I will try to do it justice. He wrote this in 1884, after the election of Grover Cleveland for the first time. If I should need to name, O Western world, your powerfulest scene and show, 'twould not be you, Niagara, nor you, ye limitless prairies, nor your huge rifts of canyons, Colorado, nor you, Yosemite, nor Yellowstone with all its spasmic geyser loops ascending to the sky, appearing and disappearing, nor Oregon's white cones, nor Huron's belt of mighty lakes, nor Mississippi's stream. This seething hemisphere's humanity, as now I'd name the still small voice vibrating America's choosing day. The heart of it, not in the chosen, the act itself, the main, the quadrennial choosing. Now, for weeks, in fact, for years, in fact, immediately after the last election and the one before that, the great concern among Americans, particularly of the Democratic persuasion, was that America couldn't run an election to save itself, that it has the most arcane and ludicrous voting system, each state different. You can't guarantee the integrity of the voting machines, which were sold in large numbers by a treasurer of the Republican Party. The queues were miles long and always were, that lawyers needed to be on hand to oversee the voting, to stop electoral officials turning away voters at 5 p.m. when they'd been in the queue since 1 p.m. All these sorts of things. On the day of the election this year, on November the 4th, the first item I heard on National Public Radio was of a university in South Carolina whose computer had been broken into, the main frame, I presume, and a letter had gone out to all staff and students under the provost's signature saying that voting would be tomorrow, Wednesday. So Whitman's optimism in this feels, at least felt, a fortnight before the election to be misplaced at best. Now, as you probably know, a condition of US citizenship is optimism. It comes hard to people like ourselves, disappointed optimists at best, pessimists more likely. But I spent 5 weeks in the US before the election and met lawyers and academics and trade union officials and teachers and barmen and baristas and barflies and illegal immigrants and all sorts of people. And I only met in all that time one pessimist. And he was a marathon runner, so I felt he wasn't really a true sample. I think that constant padding along those streets without pavements got him down. I'd admit that some of these optimists were pessimists about some things, such as the voting system. The notion was quite common that they, whoever they were, and as they varies from state to state and county to county, it was hard to say precisely who they were, but they would somehow rig the election, that something would happen. Or rather that we have no purchase on these matters, it was in the hands of God. This is also common. But confront them, any Americans I found on this trip, with the data pointing to at least the comparative decline of the United States. Things like the trade imbalance, the massive deficit, the wars that may yet prove unwinnable and that consume billions a month, the failing education system, the fact that it has now for some years, as I understand, consumed 6% more than it produces. That worries them a little when they tell them that. The low wages of America, the declining infrastructure, the failing health system or the failed health system, what is generally seen as the corruption by lobbyists of the democracy, the massive income gap, all these things. Whether they were familiar with these statistics, all of them or some of them, or whether they found them rather startling, they still said, but I'm an optimist. America, cactus, it is not. It will never be cactus. And the one man, as I said, who thought it was cactus had run 100 marathons in his 57 years and 8 100-mile races. And he didn't look manic until you talked to him for a while. And in any event, his wife was an optimist, completely optimistic, and she'd been teaching 26 years in a special education school, and or rather the special those who needed special education in elementary school. And to be an optimist after that took some doing. Whence the optimism comes, I don't think anyone quite knows. It's too easy to say it's ignorance, because lots of well-educated Americans are optimists. It's too easy to say it's a belief in the afterlife. You'll find sceptical Americans optimistic too. It seems to transcend education, culture, and religion. I sometimes think they would hate Osama bin Laden a little less if he didn't look like such a pessimist. Beards are bad. One thing about America, Will Rogers said, the one thing I know about America is that it's liberal, he said in 1932. It ain't nothing if it ain't liberal, he said. A fortnight ago, that sounded wildly anachronistic, a voice from somewhere that hadn't been heard since perhaps Michael Dukakis. No one would have said such a thing. The Clintons were careful not to talk about liberalism. Now, suddenly, since the election, it seems less quaint. Maybe America is liberal again, whatever liberal means. I mean, its name has been rather distorted in recent times. Rather like socialist, I don't know. No doubt back here it was reported that wherever Sarah Palin and John McCain went, but particularly Sarah Palin, Obama was referred to as a socialist. About as unlikely an appellation to anyone from outside as you could think of. But there you are. And the other thing I think that's worth bearing in mind about liberalism in America, as it was pointed out to me by a liberal American, is that really in all that time, since Dukakis went screaming out the door, America's never been much more than a few hundred thousand votes away from liberalism anyway. And in the last 8 years, a tiny, tiny skerrick of votes. Now, I ended up going for the last 2.5 weeks to a place called Zanesville, Ohio. I don't know what attracted me to it, perhaps Zane Grey, who came from there. It was named after a forebear of his, Ebenezer Zane, who got there in 1797. Now, if you look at Zanesville now and remain an optimist, then you are a serious optimist. Zanesville I wanted to go to. I decided to go to Ohio because Ohio has been was the crucial state in the last election. You will remember that the exit polls were showing on the afternoon of that election that the Democrats were home and hosed, and then Ohio turned, and no one's ever quite worked out. There are conspiracy theories, but the most likely thing is that a whole lot of evangelicals came out as a result of some useful Rovian politics and voted in numbers that the Democrats hadn't predicted. So Ohio was interesting to me. I was going to go to Michigan, but in the time that it took to fly from here to there, McCain pulled out of the Michigan race. It just suddenly went woof, and he gave it up. And then I was going to go to Wisconsin, and that went the same way. And a number of states just suddenly just fell away for the Republicans. So Ohio became the crucial state. I also went because I met a barman in a hotel in New Orleans who I really liked, and he came from Ohio. And I thought he was like the sort of common man American that is hard to find. The thing about Ohio is that it's really several states within one. It's a bit of everything, and it's all of those in one city in Columbus. But the north is really, you might think of it as part of Pennsylvania. It's Cleveland and it's Democrat. And in the south, it's Cincinnati, and it's sort of got a bit of Kentucky about it, and it's Republican. Columbus is where the Midwest begins, and Columbus has got a bit of everything in it, and no one knows quite what to think about Columbus, except that it's in industrial decline. There are parts of Columbus which are really depressing, even to an optimist. Zanesville is 60 miles east of Columbus, which makes it West Appalachian. You can actually see where the ice age has ended, where the glaciation has ended, and the moraine's been pushed up. And Zanesville sits in there, although a lot of Zanesvillians possibly don't know this because Zanesville, I understand, is a creationist town. And you may, if you're south of the city borders, you may teach evolution so long as a parent doesn't complain. Zanesville is rather like the way it was settled. It's sort of West Virginian. There are towns in those Appalachian hills which are so bleak you can barely stand to look at them. So you can see they're coal towns, and they've just faded into darkness, even among the glorious autumn leaves of the Appalachians. But not only was Zanesville settled from West Virginia, it was settled from Connecticut by a bunch of Connecticut Presbyterians who established themselves on the other side of the river and formed part of the Underground Railway. They were run by the Reverend Beecher, Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother. There's a lovely connection with Mark Twain and a whole strand of liberal American opinion, if you like, there. The old Presbyterian church still stands there, although it seems to be largely occupied by a new, one of those new sort of religions called the Vineyard. And the priest I spoke to chewed gum and blew bubbles while he was talking to me, sitting in the front pew. I liked him a lot. He wasn't like any Presbyterian minister I'd met. But, anyway, the town was divided fiercely between these two camps and often used to meet on the bridge which crosses the Muskingum River and we're told, had physical showdowns. It's a town of 26,000. In its heyday, it was 40,000. In its heyday, it was declared by, I think, Life magazine, no less, called it one of the model American cities. It has this most beautiful downtown area, a grid, four-story buildings, magnificent churches, two Catholic near cathedrals, one, I understand, founded by German Catholics, the other by Irish, one block apart. Many, many churches and spires, the whole thing. It's empty, this downtown. It's just, there are people there, but you hardly ever see them. The lights change, but there's no traffic. It's a strange place now. Everyone hopes it may one day revive, but it may never do. There are now only 25 or 26,000 people in Zanesville. It's cut through by not only the river, but by the I-70, the interstate that runs east-west, West Virginia in that direction, Columbus that direction. In October this year,
it was declared by Forbes magazine the seventh most, the American city, the seventh most likely to fall away completely, the seventh most vulnerable city in America. If you want to get another way of measuring Zanesville's position in America now, is that market segments are measured 1 to 210. New York is 1. It's a 1. Zanesville is a 205. You know, it's down the bottom. So it's a sort of, it's a story, it's a fabulous history of America, but it's a story of Rust Belt decline, the decline of the Appalachians. It makes you think about what America has failed to do to sort of get itself going again in the last 25 years. 18% poverty in the city. The first person I met in the Democratic headquarters there was a middle-aged woman who actually wept within 10 minutes of meeting her. She just told me what it was like feeding these children, these people who are hungry in this town, who come in from the hills who are hungry. 8.5% unemployment. Some shocking old divisions in the place, racial divisions. There's still a chapter of the Klan in Zanesville, not that I saw any. There are two militias in Muskingum County. There is that attitude to education, which is makes life very difficult for teachers, which is really a large number of parents who simply don't want their children to be better educated than they were. There is a sort of, Susan Orlean wrote an article in a recent collection of books about the American states in which she describes that sort of dark, quasi-religious attitude to everything. There's a sort of spooky side to that area, but and yet I love the joint, but I might pick up one of those cheap houses. So this sort of division, this Putnam-Zanesville division, sort of continues in various forms, and as you stay there, you unravel certain stories about the place, like why the ice cream parlour is always closed on Mondays. I've been there since 1948. It's like a kind of replica of old Zanesville, men in bow ties serving ice cream made on the premises, huge sundaes and that sort of thing. It's been there all that time. It closes on Mondays because it opened in the same year as a skating rink, which agreed that black people could skate on Mondays. So Tom's ice cream parlour closed on Mondays because he didn't want people coming into his... And it's remained so ever since. It's long outlived people's memory of the reason why. Anyway, for all this, you know, this in a sense paints a darker picture of Zanesville than most Zanesvillians would ask you, would expect you to paint. The mayor is a man called Howard Zwelling, known as Butch. Now, Butch is an optimist. He took me out to see these new distribution centres on the outskirts of Zanesville. Avon has got a massive thing, Dollar General, all these places. Time Warner's got a call centre out there. Wendy's make a couple of hundred million buns there every week or something, or year. They all pay about $8 or $9. And you find yourself, as Butch is telling you how things are going so well, you find yourself thinking, how can the country revive itself on $8 or $9 an hour? How can the most powerful country in the world be a low-wage economy? How can they accept that as good enough? It seems incredible. But such is the sort of power of the optimism that you just put it to one side. And you wonder, what is it that makes this country still believe in itself when in so many parts there's so many reasons for doubt? And one of the reasons, if you just sit there for a little while, is that the rituals of American life are so powerful. In 5 days there, I heard the same man sing on public occasions the Star-Spangled Banner 3 times. I mean, that's how you're hard put to do that anywhere else in the world. The same bloke, he just sings the Star-Spangled Banner. He did it at a Celebrate America concert, which had Johnny Cash's niece, Kelly, singing, and Miss Ohio was singing. And he did it at a scale replica of the Vietnam Memorial, which is touring the country, where buglers played taps, and it was a terribly moving ceremony. And a man who'd been imprisoned with John McCain in the Hanoi Hilton spoke very movingly. You realise it's not just reaffirming the bonds between Americans, this thing, but there is, you actually affirm the idea of America in a daily
sort of way.
And what we cynical sorts of Australians tend to pass off as, and what when we do it anyway, sounds corny to me at least. Somewhere in America, it goes very deep, and it comes naturally to them. I obviously chose to go to Zanesville because I thought it might represent something at the core of American political life, at least. Somewhere in there, it would be representative of the place that might decide the outcome of the election, who would be the next president of the world, effectively. And it was gratifying when the Lieutenant Governor of Ohio turned up after a couple of days and on a grassy slope in front of a few Democrats said that the world was watching Zanesville. There was places like Zanesville which would decide the result. And he even said they were watching in Indonesia. And he named other places. He didn't name Australia, and I kept quiet. On that same day, John McCain came to Zanesville. And he spoke in a gymnasium, a school gymnasium, about 2,000 people in it. Now, I'd seen him about 10 days before in New York at the L. Smith dinner, to which I happened to score a ticket in the Waldorf. And I think a bit of it was broadcast on television around the world. McCain was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. He had a terrific speech. But what was really outstanding about him was that he's such a natural comic. He goes for jokes. You could see that he likes what is bizarre in people or what will confront them. He later appeared on Saturday Night Live and it was tremendously impressive. I mean, he could be a stand-up comic, I'm sure. He has such natural timing and is so attracted to what's funny. Obama also spoke at this and he did well, but he didn't have that sort of natural flair as a comedian. They meant to be funny at this thing, which happened to raise $5 million for charity in one go. They were $500,000 short at half time, but they got that in no time at all. And by the time McCain got to Zanesville, which was about 10 days before the election, his stump speech had really become awful. It was a kind of disgrace. It was sad to watch, I thought. It was almost, even by stump speech standards, it was almost content-free. We don't expect much in the final weeks of a campaign. You just go on saying the same thing over and over. But McCain's had become a dreadful thing. The content was really the attack on Obama, who had said in a loose moment, although I don't think it did him any harm and probably did him good, that he wanted to redistribute the wealth. This is the Joe the Plumber thing. And McCain kept saying, redistribute the wealth, and as if this was an appalling thing. And what was odd was this audience, who was quite substantially comprised very poor people in camouflage gear and struggling people who actually had been taking redistributed wealth for a very long while, booed in unison, you know, when he said he wants to redistribute the wealth, as if to say, don't give any to us. You know, you don't want it. Take it away, dirty money. But what was more striking about it was that McCain really built the speech around, more than I realised, he built it around his war record, which is impressive. I mean, he did crash 3 planes, remember? I mean, he owes a bit on that side. He was fairly reckless with planes. But what happened to him in Vietnam was is appalling beyond imagination. And there was something sort of Roman about the whole thing, that here was this returned valiant warrior who so obviously couldn't raise his arms over his head because of the torture that was done to him. So this his whole performance was characterised by these short stabbing motions with arms that he can't get over here. So there was no disguising the fact of what had happened to John McCain. But it was almost as if someone had got to him and told him, whatever you do, don't be yourself. It didn't seem to me that McCain actually wanted to. He'd never done it before. He didn't want to get a ride on his war record. And yet quite a long while before the end of the speech, he was saying, I carry the wounds of war. I've been tested. I know how to fight. He even said at one point, that he knew how to win a war, which was something Sarah Palin first said, and the harder you tried, the harder it became to think what war it was that he'd won. Nevertheless, it did feel... I mean, no doubt the audience had a lot of military in there, a lot of poor people have connections with the military. It's one place you can go. And he played to that audience. Nevertheless, it did feel like an empty speech. And there was something about the heavy metal that he went out with that didn't ring true either. No, he went in with the heavy metal and he went out with Johnny B. Goode. Now, an outsider man was selling badges saying, not made in China, handmade by Americans. Joe the Plumber badges, great big ones. Obama didn't come to Zanesville. They were rather hoping that he would. But the marathon runner said he won't come here because it'd be too dangerous. He had been much earlier in the campaign, but for whatever reason he didn't come. But he went to Columbus on the Sunday before the election, which is 60 miles to the west, and there attracted a crowd of 60,000 people. That was sort of standard for him wherever he went. There were queues for literally for miles. And what was interesting about Obama's speech was that he seemed determined to keep the emotional level down. It was obvious all through his campaign that he didn't want to seem like the angry black man. That was really important not to. People kept hearing bits of Martin Luther King in his speech. I couldn't hear any, really. I heard one line, there's a righteous wind blowing at our backs. Apart from that, it seems to me that he kept the sort of that preacherly rhetoric out of his speech. He kept it much more cerebral and as if he was thinking all the time it's better to get an idea planted in their heads than a feeling, because an idea will direct them. The thing is to get them to vote, is to get them to work for me, not to get them feeling mad or passionate. And I think he maintained that admirably to the end. I mean, it was certainly the tone of the debates where people like Maureen Dowd, who's not always the most acute, she might be the funniest, but she's not the most acute observer, I don't think. But, I mean, she sort of wanted him to go for the jugular, and I don't think he needed to go for the jugular. It was much more effective to sit quietly and let McCain get angry than get angry himself. So people went away sort of feeling like, rather like a football team goes away after a coach tells them to take it 1 week at a time, you know. Don't get worked up, just go and vote. And he had this wonderful line that he, in the last 2 or 3 weeks of his campaign, where whenever he would mention, you know, something evil that McCain had done or that the Bush administration had done, and therefore perforce McCain was attached to it, they would boo and he would say, don't boo, vote. That was a very, very clever line. He did it every time. And it became a kind of standard routine. And the television ran it all the time. Now, I just want to mention the television briefly, because it seems to me between 2006, when I travelled around the States, and now, certain things have happened. Bill O'Reilly has aged. He was starting to sound tired. And even Hannity, who's much younger, was sounding tired too. And a new outfit called MSNBC, well, has become a kind of an aggressively liberal television station. It has young people on it like Rachel Maddow, Keith Olbermann, these people who mock Fox, so it's become the other side of Fox. And it's sort of compulsory viewing for a lot of middle America to watch the Comedy Channel with Jon Stewart. Letterman suddenly become a liberal. And McCain made a terrible blue with Letterman when he told him a lie and didn't turn up to see him, and Letterman had a week drubbing him every night until he finally had to go on there. Did well when he did, but it was a terrible mess. It was as if, in fact, McCain, it's extraordinary how political campaigners, great political campaigners have their day. And it felt throughout this campaign that Rove had capsized, that everything that had always worked for the Republicans in the last 8 years, mind you, they're only as good as a very doubtful election in 2000 and a not much more decisive one in 2004. But the idea of the Rovian genius of Republican politics suddenly began to become not just to fade, but to turn inside out. Suddenly, the whole tenor of the American media had changed, and suddenly Obama looked like the cool person, which is what you need, is the cool. And McCain looked like the man who was jerky and angry and out of control. And everything he did turned to dirt, really. Everything went wrong. And, of course, the thing that went most wrong was the financial crisis, which politics is such a mad game. You could say take the financial crisis out and maybe McCain wins, or it's much closer, who knows. But among the things he had to contend with was the spectacle of Alan Greenspan in front of a House committee, which looked totally startled, as he said, it was all wrong. For 40 years I've been wrong. My ideology was wrong, which sounds like his sociology was even worse than his economics, if that was the case. But he and Henry Waxman sort of sat there looking completely nonplussed. The game was up. This makes it very hard for a candidate which is connected to that. The mob that stand, you know, holding that particular horrible can of worms, it makes it very hard for him to separate himself. And it was odd. It was only 10 days before the end of the campaign that he actually got his line out, saying, you're not voting for George Bush, you're voting for me. You know, why he didn't say that at the beginning, I don't know. Anyway, whenever you talk about this, you think, well, on the one hand, it was an outstanding campaign by Obama, that he made barely a mistake, and he ran a phenomenally well-organized campaign in the field. On the other hand, you think, well, without the financial meltdown, who knows, he might have lost. But you can only go on what you've got, and the organization of his operation was mind-boggling, even in Zanesville. He had probably 10 times more of everything than John Kerry had had. He had 10 times more field organisers. He had 10 times more volunteers. He had 10 times more precincts defined, more neighbourhoods defined, more people organising those neighbourhoods. It was as if he'd put a net right across the country and he was going to drag up every voter he possibly could. The ambition was to first get them to get them to vote, and then to get them to vote Democrat, to say they were going to vote Democrat, and then get them to the polls. So what it might have started months before only ended at 6 o'clock on voting night or at 5 o'clock on voting night, saying, these people have not voted yet, get on the phone to them, offer to go and pick them up, drive them to the polls, whatever. And in Zanesville, the campaign brought in two young women, both highly educated young women in their 20s. I think they were in their 20s. They certainly weren't much older. Which is a terribly smart thing to do, A, because they're very professional organisers, B, because having outside organisers meant that the organisation didn't tear its respective throats out. You're in a community where there are a lot of, you know, there are various strata and layers and old memories of things, and people have never spoken to each other and so on. You bring in two organisers, they all followed the same routine. They had lawyers on hand to oversee the voting queues. They had everything. They had people come back. I met a Jewish liberal from Brooklyn who'd been away for 40 years. He came back to canvass for the last 3 weeks. He went around knocking on doors in houses where he'd never gone before, having dogs set on him and people shout at him and not knowing whether you're going to get a shotgun or not. Nevertheless, he did it. There were women in their 80s who remembered FDR and the New Deal, whose husbands had worked in WPA schemes, and people who didn't remember Ronald Reagan. There was something about watching old ladies on the last night before the election ringing up people and getting phones slammed down and just sighing and then ringing the next number and going through the routine. It was tremendously impressive, whatever side of politics you happen to be on. So much so that the next day you felt these people were going to sit around and say, well, what do we do next? Suddenly we had hundreds of people who were able to do one thing. It sort of reminded me of that, you know, one of those things which I think happens in the United States. If you think of I always thought that a place like Chicago, which managed to do this astonishing thing, they stopped the river running into Lake Michigan, turned it around and ran it south, so it now runs into the Gulf of Mexico. Because it didn't suit them having it run into Lake Michigan. It was polluting things and it stank. So they turned around ran the other way. And you think, if a city does that, or any community does that, they feel like they can do the next thing. And that really, in a way, that sort of that mixture of idealism and pragmatism in America is tremendously powerful. So these people the next day, I don't know what they're doing now, but they may have decided to clean up the river, which could do with it. Or maybe they'll single-handedly revitalise the downtown, get it going again. But that, you know, when they talked about Sarah Palin energising the Republican base, the Obama thing energised whole communities across the country, whole states, whole cities, everything. That was real energising. And the trouble with the Palin energising the base was that the more she energised, the more McCain fossilised. Because she looked like all the energy and he looked more and more like an add-on. And as time went on, she just ran her own campaign in a way that if I'd been McCain, I think I would have been looking for the poison or the fly tox or something. So you had this tremendous sense of possibility. Now, on the night, it was a great moment. To be in that hall was something unforgettable. They didn't carry Muskingum County, but they did halve the Republican margin. They got it down to 2,900 votes, and they were already thinking, well, next time we'll get it. There were scenes, as you would imagine, of unimaginable happiness. There were a lot of old black people in the room who never thought this could ever have happened. A sort of wonderment was about the place. It was quieter in the restaurant next door, which was a Republican restaurant. It was great that the two were together. It was the best restaurant and the best party, it seemed to me, going on at the same time. Now, it was remarkable, I think, for many reasons, and I've been trying to think about this ever since I came back, what it was that really got me. One of the things was that I thought, you know, I think that Obama's speech was almost lost in the moment, what a great speech that was. I mean, I think... whatever. I mean, there was also that terribly poignant moment at the beginning when McCain, the real McCain, came out and did absolutely what was necessary at that time. And it must have been incredibly painful, but the real McCain actually appeared in that very last speech, in quietening the sort of base that Palin had sort of turned into a slightly angry mob. I think we should all hope that a nice flow or something that she's standing on just drops off. I think she's, or a bear gets or something. I mean, I think she's quite a worrying person. I think she will go anyway, but that doesn't matter. Anyway, as I said, I think the moment in a way tended to bury what an amazing piece of speech-making Obama's thing was. I don't think I've ever heard a speech as good, and I doubt if I ever will. But there were these, I suppose it comes down to about three things that have struck me since. One is, it was overwhelming, it was this sense of can-do that suddenly was in this room, that all these people had done this. They felt, I mean, they hadn't been working in Michigan, they hadn't been working in the easy states. As the man from Brooklyn said, who was 60, you know, he said, I could have sat around with my liberal mates and watch all this and see it happen and whinge if Ohio falls and make the sort of remark, the one mistake Obama made when he said about these people out there with their guns and religion, they're unemployed and this is what happens to them. He could have said to him that, but instead he went out and did it. And it's interesting. Zanesville used to have... there were 165 Jewish families in Zanesville in its good days, and there were three synagogues operating. Now the synagogues have become community centres, and Howard Zwelling, the mayor, and there are, I think, another 25 or 26 families there. But it's a sort of symptom of the decline of the place. So there was suddenly this feeling the next day that America was a place in which anything can be done. Look at that. It just leapt over everybody else. Everyone had been saying, America's had it, you know, Europe's better, Australia's better. We do everything right here. Suddenly in one go, Americans did the whole lot. They got a black president, black family in the White House. Astonishing. And it was all, and you felt there that it all was grassroots. It was exactly as Walt Whitman said it was in 1884. Then there was this other thing at the airport where... It was funny, at the motel where I'd stayed for 2.5 weeks and then at the airport going back, Fox News was still on. And I mean, I'm sure there was sort of... There was dust all over the screen. And there they were, still going. The sound was turned down, but you just knew that the management just hadn't got around, hadn't caught up. They could turn them off now. And it was sort of a... In a way, I think it this has happened in the US, that particular era just ended in a flash. I wouldn't say that the culture wars are dead, but what it did feel like, and that's actually, I realised, was the most enjoyable thing of all, was that you're standing there watching a 47-year-old speak to the world. And for me, I thought, the great thing about this is I don't have to listen to my own generation anymore. It's fantastic. I can listen to a younger generation. I don't have to listen to liberals saying all the same things they've been saying for the last 35 years and the right saying all the same things. I felt this was the most liberating moment of the lot, because you can actually listen to someone else rather than the sound of your own voice, you know. Mind you, it's returned since then. I still have the same arguments in my head. But it did. It felt like there had been this great change, and that really young Americans had seized a sizable part of the power. And there was this other thing, which was, to bring it back to where I started, and that was that in a stroke, all the optimism that had seemed incomprehensible, and always has seemed incomprehensible to me in the States, at least in the last 7 or 8 years, when the place is in such dire straits, all that became comprehensible. You actually thought, well, they're right. See, that you can sit there and say to them, look, all these things, how are you ever going to turn any of this around? And they say, well, we will. I'm optimistic. They don't give any good reasons. And somehow that election was like this... without wanting to, you know, be sort of put too big a glow on it, that at least was the impression one had that actually the election... And in a way, Bush and McCain both sort of acknowledged it. That Bush was gracious. Well, he's not. He doesn't lack graciousness. He just lacks the ability to complete a sentence, mainly. But he's. But in saying that, this is a marvelous moment for America, and so, you know, they were sort of brought in as well. So I don't want to sound too much like an optimist, the whole experience was to demonstrate why American optimism has some sort of basis in fact. Okay.
Thank you.
Questions?
You go back there.
Yeah.
Janet Grundy's got some copies of Don Watson, American Journeys, and I'm sure Don would be happy to sell them, so we've got some copies of... Don's going to sign. Okay, sorry about that. And you'll be pleased to know that a lot of people turn up tonight to listen to someone of your age and my age, so that's a good sign.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of people here today, and we have ABC TV 4 here, so we've got to repeat the question. Don's going to repeat the questions, which means the question's got to be short, otherwise we'll never finish. So short questions, short comments, and we're going to finish no later than 7 o'clock. Can I just start off... I don't want to verbal you, but I think it's probably fair to say that about 4 or 5 months ago, you probably thought the Democrats couldn't win, but sometime before the election, you were calling a likely Democrat victory. What led you to change that assessment of what was going on in the United States?
Well, it's true. I always thought McCain would win because I thought... I mean, very simplistically, I suppose. I thought they didn't vote for Adlai Stevenson, so why would they vote for a black intellectual? You know, but I think what... two things. One sowed a seed of doubt. One was speaking to Philip Gurevich in Melbourne, the American writer, who, when people at a panel were in an audience were talking as if America was had it, Gurevich, who was no fan of the Bush administration, nevertheless made this rather impassioned little 3-minute speech about how silly it was to write America off, and was totally confident that Obama would win. And this was about 3 months ago. So that made me think, well, maybe, you know, there's no reason why I should believe him as opposed to anybody else, but I was impressed. But then in the course of the campaign, I think what... two things changed my mind. I think one was the day that Greenspan made that those amazing remarks in the House felt like it just wasn't possible. It would not be possible to look back and explain how it was that he could make those remarks 2 weeks before an election and the election would go the way of the Republicans. It just didn't seem possible. And then it was confirmed when I asked 12 children in the Maysville Elementary School, just outside the city limits, who was going to win the election the day before and who they wanted to win the election. 11 of 12 said Obama, to the teacher's enormous surprise. And the 12th said she wanted McCain to win, but she thought Obama would win too. So 12 out of 12, that seemed like as good a poll as you can get. So I was totally confident for the last 24 hours. Any more questions?
Right. So we'll go here. Yeah.
Do you think Obama will do what Rudd did when he first came into power, which was do some dramatic things like sign the Kyoto Protocol or something like that?
The question is, do I think that Obama will do what Kevin Rudd did when he won last year and do a few dramatic things like signing the Kyoto? You mean symbolic, rather symbolic gestures? Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't feel entirely qualified to answer this. I do know that people were recommending to Obama that he hold a summit, like Rudd did. Whether that comes to anything, I don't know. I don't know how American politicians, they are a different breed. I don't know how they can even stand up at the end of a campaign like that, let alone appoint a cabinet and deal with those things. The politicians I've worked with have had it after 6 weeks. I mean, how they run two-year campaigns, I do not know, and speak in five different cities in five different states in a day. Joe Biden came to Zanesville on the last day and delivered this impassioned speech to 500 people on the Hill, as if he just started. I don't know how they do that. But the answer is he might, but I don't think there's a lot of room for gesturing. I think, you know, that he's... the times are such that he has to do things, substantial things. I mean, it's a gesture to, I suppose, to appoint Hillary Secretary of State if he decides to do that, or to see McCain within a week of losing. These are gestures, but I think there's good political thinking in them, and I think he sees them as very necessary.
There's a question here.
How many of the 12 children, if any, in the Maysville School were of Afro-American
none
origin?
Not one. It's a segregated city. The African-Americans live in the third ward, and always have. It used to be totally segregated, I mean, officially, like a lot of Midwest cities. But not...
an even more impressive poll.
Yeah.
Right, there's a question here. Yeah.
Was it more the support of the young vote in America, or the black vote, or both?
Can you repeat that?
Was it more the young vote, or the black vote, or both? Well, I think that as they're sort of disaggregating the polls, I think they're finding that the black vote was very strong, the young vote, the Hispanic vote. So you got all those southwest states. You got Colorado and New Mexico. You got a big swing in Arizona. So... no question that sort of intensive campaign sweep and the effort to get people out to vote worked very well for him. But I don't know. I don't know what the final indicators are.
We'll go here and then we'll go down there. Okay.
Yes, on the question of the American dream, how important it is, from what I've read, a number of Muslim migrants to America accept the American dream and think, yeah, we can go up. Whereas you look at the UK, where you've got much more social security and social support for people, you have people going out and making bombs.
Yeah.
Briefly
repeat. It's hard to repeat that one.
The suggestion is that in the United States, Muslims adapt very well and take on the optimistic American dream of self-promotion, where the question is that in Britain, a lot of British Muslims are living on welfare and accepting money, but are not as happy with the society in which they live as the Muslims in the United States who don't have that kind of government support are. That's the question, I think.
Well, I agree. I don't know. Just now, we'd say that's the American dream working. As I said 3 weeks ago, it didn't feel that way. But a lot of America is a slum. I mean, one kind or another, it's a slum. And you can spend days thinking, how can they do this to themselves? How can they be so rich and yet have such unimaginable poverty of all kinds? But something there works. And it may be something that got no better name than the dream.
For those who have pay TV, there's an excellent series on at the moment on one of the movie channels, the seven-part series on John Adams, which when I was in New York in May, people were racing home to watch.
Mm.
It reminds us all of how America founded itself as an independent nation. And I wonder if the reason there is such, as you describe, poverty as well as optimism, goes back to this idea that in America, while government is strong for the symbolic and the national vision and all the rest of it, people do not want the government in their faces all the time.
Mm.
How do you see that?
Did everyone hear that question? It's really a question about the series John Adams is presently showing on pay TV, and Americans are, I suppose, educated Americans are seeing it in droves. The question is, you know, there is this sort of very powerful idea of America, which is about, I suppose, self-help, about making your own way in the world. They don't want government in their faces. I think that's true, except the government is all over in America. I mean, you find it everywhere. Where, as I said, these people who were booing the idea of redistributing the wealth, many, many of them were plainly on redistributed wealth and had been since birth. There's a funny thing about America. It's full of rules. You know, sometimes it does feel a little like the Soviet Union, especially going through airports. Or if you want to take a picture of a public building, someone's likely to tap you on the shoulder and say, you can't do that. And you say, why not? And they say, policy. A friend of mine tried to take a picture on the ferry that crosses the Mississippi in New Orleans and said, you can't film in a shopping mall. Take your camera away. You can't do that. And I'll tell you, we got rules here. That's why the country works. And the same kids who said they wanted Obama to win told us, he said, well, what's great about America? And they all said, well, we've got a constitution, we've got rights, we're free. And you said, but other people are free. Yeah, but you're not really free. In England, they said, they cut your head off. The king. the king cuts your head off. They've got a king there, and he chops your head off. The same in France, except they use a sharper thing in France. You see. A little ignorance helps, I think, you know.
In January, I heard Obama speak, and he was full of hope. I think everybody was full of hope in the audience. But on that occasion, his speech was lacked any of the arms or legs that was going to give hope any sort of chance of actually succeeding. And I wondered whether you heard what he was actually proposing, specifically bringing about the change that he so eloquently put.
Well, I think everyone heard that, did they? It was really the gentleman had heard Obama speak a while back, and you're saying really it lacked a lot of content. He talked about hope, but without saying why. Well, I remember I thought The Audacity of Hope, his second book, was more about hope than audacity. But although I think the first book is a fantastic book, what brought about the change? Well, I don't know whether it was a long-term plan to sort of, you know, just fill the thing out as he went on, but in his last, I thought his last speeches were full of content for final speeches, which are usually pretty empty. He wasn't sloganeering. He was talking about the natural way of reviving the economy was to sort of invest in energy. He was making the link between the last boom, which had been in the dot-com boom, The new boom would be in energy-efficient vehicles and in whole new ways of... So you combine the environment with the industrial necessity. His health policy sounded to me to have content. He talked about education in ways which didn't sound as vacuous as most education debates sound. I thought there was a surprising amount of content in what he said. And I got the feeling that his whole strategy was to, was always very careful not to... I mean, I think any politician has to be careful about policy because it can be the worst. Look at John Hewson. He must curse policy every day of his life. And I think he was doing a bit of non-John Hewsoning in not offering too much early on. But he did retain some content.
Question here, then we go down there. Yeah.
Quite early on in your wonderful talk, you mentioned a barman you liked in New Orleans, and you described him, I think, as the common man who was very hard to find. Can you elaborate on that? What did you mean?
I think we need to repeat.
I mentioned earlier this barman I met in New Orleans, and he... the lady's asking why I said he was like a common man who's now hard to find. Well, he didn't drop his G's. I thought that was good. Because Obama had taken to dropping his G's, because the common man's meant to drop his G's. It was really, I thought, because he sounded like... I mean, he could have... I'll tell you why, put it this way. He could have as easily been a Republican as a Democrat. I mean, it didn't really matter to him. He was a Democrat, as it turned out, because he didn't like Bush. But he felt there was nothing ideological about him at all. He was a cluey sort of a man. When people turned up, he'd have MSNBC or the Comedy Channel on, and if people turned up who looked a bit like the other way, he'd say, "You don't have to watch this, I can turn it off any time." You know? And he was always... He wouldn't put on Fox. But if I'd asked, he probably would, because he had to sell beer. But he was fascinating watching him move between the commercial side of his brain and the political side. And he was tremendously interesting to talk to. He'd been in the military for 20 years, thought a lot. He was like a character, to me, unsuggestible. But he was like a character who would have easily, Mark Twain could have got a page and a half out of.
So, final question, Peter. Yeah.
How important do you think that the win in the Iowa crime was in propelling Obama towards the presidency? Seems to me if he hadn't won that, he could well have sunk without trace.
Yeah.
Just repeat
that. The question is, how important was the Iowa primary in propelling Obama to his final success? I think so. Absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any question. If he'd gone down there, he goes down completely because Hillary got such a run on later on. But politics is like that, isn't it? I mean, you take that bit away, but there are other bits you could take away as well, and then he falls over, or she falls over. I don't know, but it certainly was a big. I mean, if you stopped and untangled the whole thing now, I don't know, and you put it all. I don't know whether you could ever put it back together again. It'd be a bit like taking a watch apart. You'd never get it back with the result the same.
So just finally, what explains your interest in America? No doubt you'll go back again in a couple of years' time, or perhaps earlier. You've got this long-term interest that comes out in American journeys. What explains that?
It took me a long while to realise. I first went to the States when I was about 30, just as at the tag end of a stint in the UK. And it took me 20 years to realise how much the US sort of stimulates you in a way like no other country on earth. That there's something goes on there that doesn't go on anywhere else, I know. And I always feel, perhaps because you hardly get a chance to speak while you're there, that you just can't stop speaking when you get home. But I love the way they talk. That's a significant part of it. I love the way they love language and love the sound of voices and I love the cadences of American language. So it's like being in a kind of a warm bath most of the time, but I think it's I don't want to sound unpatriotic, of course,
But there was something about the creation of that republic right at the beginning which made America a different place. It gave it it gave it a tremendous energy and drive, which we, as a kind of appendage of the empire, hanging on for so long as we did, never got quite the same out of things. I mean, you have to write, you have to gloss over a lot of brutality that came out of that same republic, but I'll give you one little anecdote. It was a, I'm trying to desperately think of his name, that old utilitarian, Bentham. Bentham, was it Bentham? Wasn't it? But it wasn't Bentham, it was the other one, the populist one. Anyway, he wrote about, if you're going to go to America, he said, if you're going to, it was encouraging people to emigrate. But he was saying, whatever you do, don't get on a British ship. This is in about, after the failure of the Reform Bill, he decided that Brits may as well get out of there. But he had one piece of it, well, he had two pieces. One, don't take your wife if you can possibly avoid it. The second was, especially if she's a pious woman, he said. But the second bit of advice was, he said, at all costs, don't get a British ship or any other European ship, get an American ship. Because an American ship, the captain will never sleep. He'll be up all night, 24 hours a day. They carry more sail. Their sailors are better. They work harder. They'll get you there in half the time and much in better condition. In other words, what he recognised when he went to America, it blew his mind, was that this place where Britain was sort of befuddled and messing around and hanging on to other things, America was zooming on. And I don't think, you know, maybe this is another one, you know. This is another takeoff. Maybe not, I don't know. Maybe capitalism is dead, as some people say, but you don't get that feeling just now.
Many thanks, John. Well, there are a lot of people here today, so I'll be very brief. Don Watson speaks well on a number of topics, but clearly he understands America very well. We've seen that in American Journeys. We've heard it here again tonight. So, as I said, there's some copies of American Journeys on sale that Janet Grundy's got. I think it's been a wonderful night tonight, and it was great to hear Don's reflections following the presidential election. So, well done tonight. No doubt you'll be back again in the future, but for now, thank you.
Thanks, John.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.